On November 7th, 1997, in the city of Sarasota, Florida, a 13-year-old girl dialed 911.
Hello?
Hello?
Hi, this is the 911 center. What's the matter?
Oh my God.
Okay, what's going on?
My mom.
Your mom what?
My mom is dead.
Okay, what makes you think that?
She's blood all over the place and she has a cut on her neck.
Who else is in the house there?
I have my brothers and sisters.
How old are you?
I'm 13.
Okay, stay on line. Are your brothers and sisters younger than you?
43 months.
Okay, Stevie, we have help on the way, okay?
The name of the 13-year-old making this call is Stevie Bellish. Stevie had just arrived home from school around 4:15 p.m., at which time she had found a trail of blood leading from the front door into the kitchen. Inside the kitchen, she found her 35-year-old mother lying in a pool of blood with her neck cut and what appeared to be a gunshot wound to her head. Not only was her mother's body and the floor of the kitchen covered in blood, Stevie's four younger half-siblings, which were all still toddlers, were found crawling through the house covered in their mother's blood as well, leaving baby-sized tracks in almost every room on the main floor. Although the toddlers seemed to be inside the house at the time that their mother was murdered, each child was found completely unharmed. Investigators from the Sarasota County Sheriff's Office were the first to respond to the Mark Ridge Road residence, a house which was home to the deceased, her two teenage daughters, and the four infant children. Retired Detective Sergeant Chris Iorio and retired Captain Ron Albritton secured the crime scene. Inside the garage, investigators found a towel with what appeared to be a bullet hole through it. This towel also contained gunshot residue. Investigators also located a bullet casing near the laundry machines. And while further searching this area, they discovered a thumbprint on the side of the dryer. When searching the area directly surrounding the body, detectives discovered a broken steak knife covered in blood, as well as a phone with blood on the handle. This led investigators to believe that the deceased was likely making an attempt to call for help before she collapsed. Her husband was then notified of what happened, and he arrived on the scene and greeted his two stepdaughters, as well as the four infant children. When officers asked him to provide a statement, his reply was, "I will talk to you once I have a lawyer." He then ceased all communication and stayed by his children. Something you may have been wondering, as I have yet to disclose, is the name of the deceased. This is because her name is one that may be recognized by avid gossip magazine consumers or even early reality TV enthusiasts, as just 2 years earlier, in 1995, she had become somewhat of a pop culture phenomenon, known as Sheila Bellish, the Quad Mom. You see, in 1995, after marrying her second husband, Jamie Bellish, Jamie and Sheila were doing their best to have children together. However, things were not working in their favor, and conceiving naturally was proving to be very difficult for the two. So, Sheila began fertility treatments, and before you know it, Sheila and Jamie were pregnant, with not just one or two children, but four all at once. When the local news caught wind of this miraculous sequence of events, they found Sheila's story fascinating, so they then launched Sheila and Jamie into the limelight, which is what eventually led to Sheila being labeled as the Quad Mom. Cameras and reporters checked in with them regularly, and several stories were publicized about the family. With this level of small-town fame, surrounding what appeared to be a kind and caring family residing in a middle-upper-class area of Sarasota, investigators and locals alike were all concerned as to what may have motivated somebody to commit this crime. Although some locals began to speculate that there may be a thrill killer on the loose, investigators quickly ruled that out based on the way that the crime scene was discovered. They suspected that this was more than likely the result of a targeted attack perpetrated by an amateur hitman, based on the story that the injuries and the evidence told. Although Sheila was left in a fairly gruesome way, she was only shot once in the head, and the weapon used to cut her throat was left directly next to the body, And as it turns out, that knife was actually from Sheila's very own knife set. Detectives believed that the assailant likely used the towel as a makeshift silencer. However, after shooting the gun once, the towel jammed inside the weapon, causing the assailant to grab for the knife to finish the job. Once the assailant had believed that Sheila was going to die from her injuries, they left the house, closing the door behind them in order to keep the crawling babies inside. Basically, investigators felt that there was somebody from Sheila's life who harbored an intense hatred for her, or felt that their life would be much easier without her in it. After about 48 hours had passed, Jamie Bellish contacts the police, stating that he has now obtained an attorney and he would like to provide a statement.
Her ex-husband, he's very, very wealthy. He's got like 3 different cars, plays golf all the time, lives in 8,000 square feet home. He's very manipulative, he's very abusive. Is it company? During the final divorce, she was awarded 20% of that company, as well as $170,000 for pain and suffering, whatever, and civil damages. I assume he wasn't happy about that. As soon as she started collecting on the civil stuff, he claimed bankruptcy.
Jamie was quickly ruled out, as he provided a very solid alibi, being 93 miles away in Fort Myers for work. Friends and family would also specify that Jamie was a stand-up guy that they did not believe would have any motive to murder the mother of his children. After ruling Jamie out, detectives did some research into Sheila's ex-husband, the wealthy entrepreneur who lives in San Antonio, Texas. This is Alan Blackthorne. Alan was known to be a financially successful man with very few genuine friendships. Even in business, Alan was known as somebody who was willing to be cutthroat and take legal risks. Alan and Sheila met in the early 80s in Topeka, Kansas. Together, they moved to San Antonio, where they had their 2 daughters, Stevie and Daryl. Since Alan was already wealthy by the time him and Sheila got together, it's been said that Sheila would mention to her friends that Alan always thought he was invincible. Until one day in the late 80s, when Alan got into a road rage-fueled confrontation with a biker. Alan then intentionally ran the biker over and left him with fatal injuries. Alan was then charged and went on to defend himself in court. Sheila testified for Alan, stating that Alan only hit the biker because they felt that the biker was going to hurt them if he didn't. The charges against Alan were dropped, and he continued living his self-proclaimed invincible lifestyle. However, during the years following the trial, friends of Sheila's started noticing bruises and other injuries on Sheila's body. So, eventually Sheila decided to leave Alan due to his abusive and controlling tendencies and file for divorce, seeking full custody of their daughters. Sheila then went on to meet Jamie while still in San Antonio. When the divorce was settled, she was granted an approximate total of $1,170,000 to be paid to her by Alan. She was also granted full custody of their daughters, and her and Jamie moved to Sarasota, Florida together. After the move, they did their very best to keep the new address away from Alan Blackthorne. Anyways, regardless of the tumultuous relationship between Alan and Sheila, officers were unable to find a direct link between Alan and the murder of his ex-wife. So, investigators continued following the evidence and reached out to the public for any tips or assistance locating the perpetrator.
I'm 95 years old. It's the worst crime I ever heard in my life.
On the third day after the murder, they received a call from a local gas station employee that stated that on the afternoon of the murder, a strange man approached her asking her for directions to Mark Ridge Road. She pulled out a map and provided him with assistance, and he went on his way. Investigators then took this map and found another fingerprint on it, which seemed to match with the thumbprint that they found at the crime scene. On the fourth day, officers received another phone call from a local gardener named Jacob Mast, who was across the street from Sheila's home hours before she was found dead. This gardener stated that he noticed a strange man driving around Sheila's house, acting very suspicious. So, he looked at the license plate and made up an acronym to help him remember the plate number. He then provided the plate number to the officers. Yes, Bob Runs, 62 Girls. YBR62G. After running the tag, officers found that the vehicle belongs to a woman named Maria Del Toro, living in Texas. So, officers contacted Maria, and she says that she no longer uses the vehicle. However, her grandson, Joey Del Toro, still uses it. Now that the officers have the name of the man whose fingerprint was found at the crime scene, they were certain that they were closing in on the killer. However, locating Joey proved to be very difficult, as Joey had already fled to Mexico. So instead, they spoke to one of Joey's ex-girlfriends, who said, "If you can't find Joey, I suggest you speak to his cousin Sammy Gonzalez, as the two are very, very close." So that's exactly what they did.
Tell me what you know about this incident.
Apparently this has been built, supposed to be school beater up.
Supposed to be just a beating and nothing about the killing was supposed to be occurred. That is all the news and that about to be discussed.
Who committed this murder?
Who said that told him?
Just want to get the truth out. I feel very big by this.
Said that he had shot her, but eventually I guess she was still moving or something like that.
Initially, Sammy was stating that the plan was to strictly beat Sheila and leave. However, as the questioning continued, Sammy began to open up even more and express that a man named Danny Rocha had hired him to find somebody to beat Sheila and possibly even kill her.
At some point in time, Danny Rocha told Joey De La Torre that he might as well kill her.
He said that yeah, the best way we'll to do it just if you want to give 10 grand is to kill her.
You said before shoot her. Did that slip up, or is it possible he said kill her and shoot her?
Well, just kill her. You know, just say shoot her or just stab her or whatever.
Okay.
Not only did Sammy mention that Danny Rocha was arranging all of this, he even brought up another very familiar name. Sammy claimed that Sheila's ex-husband, Alan Blackthorne, was the one paying Danny to make all of these arrangements.
And getting back what Danny told you in reference to what Alan Blackthorne told him, it is your opinion that when he said beat her up real bad where she couldn't, well, where she wouldn't be able to keep the child, what did that mean to you?
To me, it meant like provide or to be assistant to the child, and unlikely the child will go back to Alan.
Okay, so beat her up bad enough that she wouldn't be able to care for her child, is that what it meant to you?
Correct.
As alluded to in the last part of that conversation, it became clear to investigators that this murder-for-hire plot was all coordinated as a desperate attempt by Alan to regain custody of his daughters. As it turns out, Sammy Gonzalez worked at a golf course that both Danny Rocha and Alan Blackthorne played at. The two played together quite often, and it's been said that Danny Rocha made a comfortable income gambling and hustling businessmen on the course. Since Danny didn't appear to have any real career aside from these hobbies, many have speculated that Danny was already making thousands of dollars hustling Alan on the course. So aside from making a few extra dollars by arranging a murder for Alan, it is very likely that Danny had sat through many hours of Alan complaining about and bashing his ex-wife. Anyways, at this point in the investigation, detectives finally had enough information to make an arrest. So they first arrest Danny Rocha with the hopes of him cracking under the pressure and providing them with a direct link to Alan Blackthorne. Unfortunately, Danny kept his lips sealed and claimed that he had zero involvement in the murder. Officers then charged Danny with conspiracy to commit murder. While Danny sat in the county jail, it became public knowledge that Alan Blackthorne was now the main focus of the investigation. So instead of lawyering up and keeping quiet, Alan participated in multiple news interviews proclaiming his innocence.
Turned on the news and the announcer came on and said, "Sarasota police say the ex-husband did it. The search is on for the ex-husband." At that point, I mean, not only are you just kind of dumbfounded, but Maureen said, "You know what? We better get a lawyer." I went out of my way to make sure that I had little to no contact. I didn't want any contact. I had moved on with my life. Everybody has said, "Oh, why is he staying so quiet? Why didn't he talk to the media? Why didn't he do this?" I mean, if I come out and talk to the media, am I sly and slick? Or if I stay quiet, am I shy and hiding? Guilty and hiding? She was my daughter's mother. I'd already given up my parental rights. Who did those girls have left?
That's tough when you're guilty until proven innocent. It's a tough spot to be in. I pray no one else has to find themselves in that position.
I think in the beginning, people couldn't help but think I was guilty. I've been pretty thoroughly investigated. I was thoroughly investigated in Florida.
Regardless of Allen's persistent public claims of innocence via several different news broadcasters, police were already confident that they were hot on his trail. Charges had now been placed against Sammy Gonzalez and Danny Rocha. Unfortunately, without Danny admitting to Allen's involvement, police were having a difficult time obtaining a warrant to arrest Allen. The other person that officers had yet to talk to and had hoped possessed a possible link to Allen was the trigger man, Joey Del Toro. But Joey was still on the run.
The Eagle Pass police, hoping Jose Luis Del Toro's photo now splashed across newspapers will eventually lead to his arrest. Mexican authorities are cooperating fully in their search for Del Toro, a 21-year-old drifter wanted for murdering Sheila Bellish in Sarasota, Florida, almost a week ago.
Until November 19th, about 5 days after Sammy and Danny were charged.
Joey
was finally arrested in Mexico. Although things were looking up, the battle that detectives faced now was getting Joey extradited back to the USA, which in some cases can take years. While they worked towards Joey's extradition, Danny started to get frustrated that he was sitting in jail, while Allen continued golfing almost every day.
Here, I'm trying to do the right thing, and I'm trying to make a deal, and you know, he's back here in San Antonio, playing golf 5 days a week.
Danny then agreed to provide a statement to officers regarding Allen's involvement. He did so while being hooked up to a polygraph machine. The story he told was very colorful. However, it appeared to be full of fabrications as he severely failed the polygraph test. In January of 1999, just over a year after the murder, Danny and Sammy were then convicted for their parts in the interstate conspiracy to commit murder.
See the jury find as follows as to count one of the charges. The defendant is guilty of principal to murder in the first degree.
Danny's constant choice to withhold information left him with a life sentence, whereas due to Sammy's immediate cooperation with authorities, he received a lighter sentence of 19 years. Unfortunately, investigators still had yet to arrest Allen, but that didn't mean that they had quit gathering evidence against him. They then had an epiphany. Since multiple parties were accusing Allen of at very least arranging to have his ex-wife injured, they had grounds to press charges based on something known as the Violence Against Women Act. Basically, this meant that if a spouse or ex-spouse traveled across state lines to commit some sort of abuse, authorities have the right to detain and press charges. So by linking Joey Del Toro's travel on the day of the murder back to Allen Blackthorne, officers could finally arrest and charge Allen as well. And that's exactly what they did. Allen was immediately charged with interstate domestic violence before finally being charged with interstate conspiracy to commit murder on January 4th of the year 2000. Almost exactly one full year after Danny and Sammy received their sentences. During Allen's trial, the prosecution laid out the evidence that was collected against Allen, which indicated that Allen was a bitter ex-husband that would do anything to get his daughters back, including paying off three men $10,000 each to murder his ex-wife. Not only did they have Sammy Gonzalez's statements against him, but now they had Danny Rocha willing to testify against him as well. Danny would state that the plan was hatched by Allen in mid-July 1997, while the two were out golfing. The topic came up when Allen would constantly complain about how his ex-wife was abusive to his children, and she needed to be taught a lesson. It then escalated to him directly asking if Danny knew anybody that could do something like that, before finally getting to the point of saying, okay, well, when it's done, maybe feed her to the alligators. Insinuating that he wanted her beaten and then killed. In addition to the testimony provided by both accomplices, prosecutors also found a pattern in Allen's phone call history, which aligned with the narrative provided by Danny. At one point, in early 1997, Allen had convinced his daughter Daryl to tell the police that her mother was beating her. Daryl did so, which resulted in Sheila being arrested for a short period of time. Daryl later came to a realization of what happened and told the police that she wasn't abused, she was just disciplined because she had done something wrong. Daryl was aware that her father misled her into believing that a minor punishment could be constituted as abuse. Sheila was then released with no further issues. However, during the month of July 1997, while Allen was having these devious conversations with Danny, Allen was on a hunt to figure out Sheila's new address, and his phone call history was a clear indication of this. He even called the bail bond agency, attempting to maneuver the address from them. He was not aware that the phone call was being recorded.
You folks have a bond on a Sheila Bellish.
Well, I can't release that information. I don't know who you are.
Okay, what I'm trying to figure out is that, well, I'm somebody that they owe money to and they skipped out of state on me. I'm just trying to figure out where out of state that they run.
Well, I don't know.
That would hurt a child.
This is true.
Although Allen was not able to get Sheila's address through these schemey attempts, he stooped even lower and manipulated his daughter Daryl into telling him where they lived, so he could visit them on Christmas. Daryl never heard from Allen again after that. Allen's phone records indicated that he clearly got the information he was looking for after speaking to Daryl, as his phone usage then slowed right back down and returned to normal. Allen's defense attorney went on to claim that Danny Rocha was a con man who not only relied on the money that he made from hustling businessmen at the golf course, but he also used information against these same businessmen. They stated that in this case, Danny knew that Allen was having trouble with his ex-wife, so Danny took the initiative and arranged this entire murder on his own. He was hoping that he would win over Allen's praise, and Allen would provide Danny with eternal financial stability. In July of 2000, Allen Blackthorne was convicted for interstate domestic violence and interstate conspiracy to commit murder. He was handed two life sentences to be served concurrently, without the possibility of parole. The same week that Allen was convicted, Joey Del Toro was extradited back to the United States and was finally ready to provide his statement.
I saw Sammy, and we got into a golf cart, and we went around to the little ride, and he told me that he had a job for me to do. He was concerned beating up a person. I asked him, well, what did it pertain to, And she says, well, it pertains to somebody that beats up his or her children. He didn't specifically say her, but his or her children. And I go, oh, okay. I thought it was pertaining to something that was owed, something that was owed to Danny, because I thought the job was for Danny, but he said it was for somebody else. And I go, okay, so for who? And he says, well, I'm not supposed to tell you, but it's for that in Allen Blackthorne. I brought the money, $3,500. The words that I received were that it would be better if she was dead, better for Blackthorne, and it would be better for you. They said you would get more money. Plus, he'll give you $10,000 when he receives his children.
Was there any mention of a firearm at that time?
I had mentioned a firearm. I saw, because...
This is you and...
me and Danny. Me and Danny, because since they said that it would be better off for her to die, I asked him, well, how?
You said they, so Sammy was also saying it would be better at that time?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And I said, well, how, And Sammy says, well, I guess shoot her. You shoot her and get it over with, It's easier. She won't scream or she won't do anything, whereas if you would beat her to death, you'd have problems.
Basically, what you seen her doing with the kids was a loving, caring mother.
Yes, she was. She was a loving, caring mother. Actually, I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to do it because, like I said in the courtroom, it wasn't me. And I'm going to say something, and that's probably the only thing that I'll say concerning what happened in the house. But I was about to leave when she noticed that the door was open. Because he had left the door open to the laundry room that goes into the garage. I left the door open and she noticed it. And I saw her notice it, and I couldn't run, I couldn't do anything, and so, well,
Joey's statement only went on to further corroborate the narrative as provided by Sammy and Danny. He even confirmed the assumption regarding the towel being used as a makeshift silencer, which caused the gun to jam. Virtually every piece of the puzzle had finally come together after speaking with Joey. After providing his confession, Judge Paul Logan sentenced Joey Del Toro to 2 consecutive life sentences in August of the year 2000. Alan Blackthorne spent several years locked up at the Beaumont Federal Penitentiary in Texas before being brutally attacked by a prison gang and being stabbed 13 times. He was then moved to the Terre Haute Penitentiary in Indiana, where he spent 4 more years before his sudden death on November 18, 2014. Alan Blackthorne's cause of death has never been released.
Ten News reporter Isabel Mascarenhas has been covering this case since it first happened 22 years ago, and she explains why no one expected what happened in court today.
Danny Rocha walks into a Sarasota courtroom looking disappointed on a day that he had hoped a judge would throw out his life sentence and grant him a new trial. But instead,
we will be resting our case.
Rocha's attorney told Judge Hunter Carroll they would not be calling any witnesses. That included convicted killer Jose Del Toro. Last month, Rocha said in court, Del Toro signed an affidavit saying all Rocha did was give him Sheila Bellish's address. He never intended for him to enter the home.
Based on the affidavit, I was not involved in the burglary.
Del Toro is serving a life sentence, and so is Rocha, though he believed he had a chance to get out of jail.
And you understand, sir, that you are not going to call Mr. Del Toro, you're not going to meet your burden of proof.
Yes, sir.
Your life sentence that you are challenging is going to remain.
The judge asked if he had been threatened or forced into this decision.
No, it's just based on a conversation I had in the last 2 minutes with my attorney.
Rocha's attorney and family would not comment on the latest developments, but the assistant state attorney thinks Rocha realized he didn't have a case.